Hi, and welcome to Archery Ops Podcast, brought to you by Gold Tip Arrows and Beestinger Stabilizers. On each episode, we talk to top experts in archery and bow hunting about what it takes to shoot better and hunt better, target after target, hunt after hunt, shot after shot. I'm your host, Tim Gillingham. Let's roll. But anyway, I just wanted to, welcome you on to the new Gold Tip Archery Ops Podcast, your episode number 10.
Awesome.
And, our goal with the audience or the archery ops is to bring guests in here that people can learn from, people that are experts in their field. There's a lot of guys out there that I come in contact running shooting staff and through my archery career that are absolute experts in penetration. They're experts in hunting. They have just adventure stories galore that would be very entertaining. I did one with Alan Bolin yesterday. That was pretty interesting. I got to know him a little bit better and what makes him tick, I don't know if you and I could pass up 22 doll sheep with a bow. Could you?
I don't think I'd pass up one doll sheep.
I know. It's crazy. It's crazy. He passed up 22 doll sheep, never killed one with a bow because he's looking for a booner.
Really?
Oh. Yeah. But if you've ever seen
this, you know me and how itchy my trigger finger is. Hell, I just shot a freaking 2.5-year-old deer in New York the other week because I just didn't want to not fill a tag.
Yeah, it was still fun. It was still fun. You run your own podcast. What do you call your podcast?
Days in the Wild. Used to be called Interviews with the Hunting Masters. My podcast is the longest running hunting podcast.
Yeah, you've been at it for quite a while. I've been on your podcast at least once, I remember.
Well, I think three times, to be honest.
It all runs together. So
yeah, I mean, hell, I've been doing it since 2006.
Oh, so you started doing it when podcasts started being a thing, huh?
It wasn't even a thing.
Yeah.
Actually, a podcast, you had to download it to an iPod then.
An iPod, huh? I don't think I ever had an iPod in my whole life.
Yeah, it was, and we kind of like pioneered it, the streaming thing, because I put it on the Hunting Channel online,
mm-hmm.
and we made it so that that guys who had memberships could consume the podcast, and that's basically how we had it set up.
Okay,
I was only doing one a month for a very long time, and now I went. At some point I was doing two a week but now it's once a week. So,
right. Well, let's just get straight to the point. I want to learn about, and I had never even known this hunt existed. Kind of like you, I listened to your video the other day and I was like, kind of like you, when you first was introduced to you, you had no idea it even existed.
Mm-hmm.
There's this little spot down the Florida mountains in New Mexico that have a herd of ibex, and I had, a guy on this podcast a while back that is just a big ibex hunter, and it was pretty interesting to hear him talk about it. But he does it in Spain and all over the world, but this is kind of a unique thing. Tell us a little bit about the Florida mountains and the opportunity as a bow hunter. I know it's less and less as a non-resident now since they changed mm-hmm. the laws, but it's there are ways through outfitters and stuff to get a tag there, but I've heard it's one of the most challenging. I've had guys like Darren Collins, who is just, a renowned bow hunter,
mm-hmm.
Tell me it's the toughest hunt he's ever been on.
It is. Well, they used to call it the 2% club.
Yeah.
If you got one. Because it was a hunt that had the highest abandonment rate of any hunt out there. So that means the guys would draw the tag, they'd go out there, they'd put 3-4 days into it and be like, shit, excuse my French, I gotta get away from this thing. This is like, I'm not gonna make this happen.
Really want this as bad as I thought I did.
It's
there's a lot of hunts brutal. That I feel that way, actually.
Yeah. Right. Well, there is, there's the physics. There's a physicality is there on a lot of hunts, especially, you went mountain goat hunting. I'm sure that was pretty physical hunt.
My elk hunt I just finished was probably the most physical hunt I've ever been on.
Elk hunting is always physical. That
Pavant unit is brutal.
Is it? Okay.
Roads on top and everything's 1500 vertical down.
Well, where I've been hunting, matter of fact, that bull that's my screenshot behind me, that it's might as well all be wilderness because there's no roads, zero. Like all the roads are down at the bottom, and everything you got to hike up. Like every morning, you're hiking unless you spike out there, which I, you know, if you want to get into that, I'll get into. I don't do for some reason. I just I'm a better. I perform better when I get a better night's sleep, and I would rather hike out 3, 4 miles.
Really?
Yeah, I'm weird like that. Like,
Yeah, I'm not that way at all, 'cause I'm not a morning person, and if I've got 4 hours of sleep, I ain't getting out of bed.
yeah. Well, I doesn't matter where I'm at. I get the same 6 to 7 hours of sleep. Doesn't matter,
Yeah.
you know.
There's
So.
a there's a there's something about an elk bugling while you're in your sleeping bag that makes you want to get up.
Yeah. But those are the things that keep me up all night if I heard bugling, then I wouldn't sleep at all. And I'd be good for 2 days, 3 days, and then I'd be
Yeah,
like,
well, used to hunt Idaho, and it was the same way. I would hike back to the camp every day, and I was just destroyed.
yeah.
And
You got to be prepared to do the 10 mile days.
oof, those are hard too, boy.
Yep.
Especially when there's 3 or 4,000 vertical in them.
Yeah, absolutely. That's brutal. But yeah, I mean, so the thing about the ibex hunt is it's all cliffs. It's like super nasty. There's snakes in every freaking hole. Like you can't,
Really?
you're afraid to put your hand to grab to pull yourself up. You know, you're constantly, and
There's
both my
that
hunts
many
were in October.
snakes.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's infested, and there's Mojaves, you know, down there. So it's not just, hey, I'm going to get bit by a rattlesnake and, you know, I'm pretty close to denning. I can run and get, aid. You know, you get bit by a freaking Mojave, you're, if you're not 15, 20 minutes from somewhere, you're going to get some serious damage. 'Cause you know, they got both venoms. They have both the,
What is that behind?
neurotoxin and the hemotoxin.
Yeah, on your behind your image on there, it's kind of fading in and out. What is that?
Oh, it's an elk hide. That's an elk hide that's on the here, I'll get rid of that for you if you want to see. My office is a disaster. I just took all my mounts down, and I was filling in holes and repainting stuff, but
Yeah.
yeah, so
I'm
I
re That's my Saturday project. My office is getting
see, that's what you're
wet.
seeing back there. Yeah,
That don't matter. That's fine. We're good with that. It don't matter. I think they probably would rather have that than all that other distraction,
gotcha. All
but
right, we'll go with
you're way too high tech to put in all that background and stuff.
that.
But anyway, yeah, that's crazy. That many snakes. I hate snakes.
So do I, man. And I live in Arizona, so I'm used to dealing with snakes, but you know, they're it's brute like brutal to have to think about like all that, and then everything is just steep. The wind is ridiculous. One second it's going this way, you take 2 steps forward, it's going the other way. Like you never know
Did
what's
you
up,
where?
and the animals themselves are. Honestly, they're just supernatural. If you can take all the best senses from all the animals that you've hunted, you know, so you hunt antelope, you know, antelope have the greatest eyesight. Okay. You hunt bears got the greatest sense of smell. You hunt a coos deer, they're super cagey, you know, like they have this sixth sense about, you know, all these things, and you just throw it all into one and you make an ibex. Which is like Spider-Man. It can climb. I mean, if you did watch that video, you'll see them. Like they're literally, they need about, I think, from what I understand from my biologist I talked to, they need about 5% grade. So if straight up and down zero, they need 5%.
So they can climb an 85% or an 85 degree.
Or 95 degree.
Well, 90's this.
Well, oh yeah,
So
yes. Okay.
85, they can
Correct.
climb an 85. Oh.
It's stupid. Like, yeah.
That's crazy. I get this question a lot. How important are my stabilizers? Well, stabilizers probably one of the most important things on my bow. Its job is to control the motion before, during, and after the shot. That helps us hold steady. It helps hold the bow still while the bow is loading and unloading from full draw to static. And it also controls the bow against our mistakes, so it makes it more forgiving. With Beastinger, you get a lightweight, high modulus bar with vibration dampening built into the bar. This is very critical in terms of getting the most out of your stabilization system. If you want to learn more, check out beastinger.com.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I think you were telling me, I don't know if you or somebody else was telling me about a shot they tried to make at one straight down and the wind blew the arrow into the cliff or something.
That was me. That was on my 2016 hunt.
Not only do you have left and right wind, you have...
Yep.
In and out wind.
I made that shot twice thinking that I made a mistake, you know, that I picked the wrong pin. I shot. It was the craziest thing. So there's a billy underneath me standing on this little pinnacle rock, and he's, straight down below me. And the wind was blowing in my face so hard, probably, I don't know. If I had a guess, probably 30 miles an hour.
Wow.
And, you know, I drew back. And my rangefinder gave me, I think it was 40 yards or something at the time, gave me 40 yards with, you know, with the cut and everything. Also, I'm like, oh, slam dunk, 40 yards. I'm going to drill this guy. I shot and the arrow hit right at its feet, you know, perfect left to right, just like right where it was supposed to be, but hit the rock that it was standing on. Sparks went flying. That billy jumps off and I'm thinking to myself, shit, there goes my opportunity, you know, because you don't get a lot. 5 seconds later, another billy jumps up on the same rock and I'm like, all right, well, I range again. I'm like 40. Okay. I must've picked the wrong pin. And even then I actually added like an inch on my shot placement.
Yeah.
And again, I hit low and I'm like, what the heck is going on? And then it just dawned on me lately. I'm like, the arrow's going like this. The wind's hitting the whole time, pushing it
yeah.
back.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Down. You know, like there's no, you know,
of course. Tricky. That's I don't even know what you would do other than just try to calculate, you know, what a 30-mile crosswind.
I would have had to add like 10 yards. I mean, based on where both the arrows hit.
Yeah. It probably about depending on your arrow weight and stuff, you know, something like that, you know, a hunt like that, you know, you'd probably want to go and you knew you were dealing with those conditions. You'd want to shoot like a Pierce Tour. You'd want to shoot it heavy and you'd want to shoot it fast as you could, you know?
Yeah.
Just to kind of, and really small veins with like a thorn broadhead, that would probably be the absolute best, you know, targeted projectile in that situation. And you'd still have issues.
Yeah. I shot on that shot in that particular hunt. So the hunt before that, I was shooting the pro hunters.
Mm-hmm.
And I shot my helium. That was in 2015. This one, I think the video's on. In 2016, when this happened, I was shooting, I had just switched to the Pierce Platinums. And I was shooting a 300 spine. I think my total grain weight on the whole thing, because I was just matching. I mean, the hunt prior to year before, I ended up making a 75 yard shot with about the same weight, about 429 total weight. You know, I'm a 29 inch draw. So this was about the same, 429. Sure. And I was shooting Schwacker at the time with a 2 inch. And, yeah, man, I had a complete pass through at that 75 yard shot. And, I just happened to get it where I was in a canyon and there wasn't, you know, it was windy, but it wasn't like stupid windy. And I'm used to wind. I go to South Dakota every year. I mean, in South Dakota, if it's not blowing 15, it's blowing 30. So it's like, you know.
Yeah. One of the best shots I ever made was over in Nebraska, you know, in the wind. And I tell people, today, you know, I've always had a reputation of, in tournament archery being good in the wind. And part of it's the way I trigger the shot, but also is I go out and shoot in the wind when the wind blows. And
Same here.
because I know that's going to be a skill set that I need to learn how my bow reacts in the wind. I need to learn how, how to stabilize the bow to hold best in the wind. And then I need to get a basic Spidey sense of what that wind's going to do to my arrow. And
100%.
that year I was shooting a 515 grain arrow at 318 foot a second. I
Yeah.
mean,
Well,
it was
that's moving.
amazing in the wind. And but that was 80 pounds, and those days are, I
Yeah.
don't try to go above 75 anymore, but
Well, I don't shoot over 70 anymore. Hell, I'm actually considering, because my next trip is South Dakota, and it's so damn cold there, and I'm wearing so much crap
yeah.
that I've
Steve,
had it now 3 times where I couldn't come to full draw because I was sitting there freezing my ass off, and then
oh, really?
I finally got a, an opportunity. 'Cause you hike, you bust your ass to get in a place, and you're sweating your freaking nuts off, and then you get into position, and you gotta wait. It might be an hour, until the animals move into the right places and you can make
Oh,
the
yeah.
yeah. And by that time you're cold, and you go to draw back, and you're like, oh, why can't I get this damn thing back? And you're like, oh, well, I got all this crap on and I'm cold. And so I might actually bring my turkey bow with my 60-pound bow with me and shoot that, because I don't want to run into that. Last year I had that problem. I had a beautiful buck. Like, it was the last morning, and I was sitting there in a heater bodysuit. I went and snuck up into this because I kept seeing them early in the morning passing through this windbreak. And I was like, oh, let me go sit there. I'm not going to do the spot and stalk game, because obviously the snow was crunchy. It wasn't like ideal. So I'm like, I'm going to go sit there. I put a heater bodysuit on. I thought I'd be all right. Still froze my
Really?
butt off.
I've got one of them in a box up here just waiting for the first time I can use it.
Yeah, there
Because I
is.
swore I knew.
And as I've gotten older, the cold bothers me more,
Yeah.
and that I don't carry as much fat on me, I guess. I think maybe, but yeah, he came out 30 yards, read the playbook. He was raking a tree, like 20 yards to my right, and then he steps out, and I'm like, okay, here we go. And I went to draw, and I'm like, what the? I can draw if I do this, but like a concealed draw, I couldn't do. And
Really?
by the time, like, he turned where he wasn't looking at me, he started walking away. So I did that, and then I tried to get him to stop, and he wouldn't stop. And he was too quartering away from me to, like, I was like,
Yeah.
I didn't want to screw it up and hit him in the hip or something. But yeah,
Yeah,
so.
lessons. It's funny how we always get the lessons on the best bucks. I still remember this giant. I don't even know how big he was. Player player on the Wasatch Front, where you got to earn them, you know, 2,000 vertical and 4 miles before daylight deal. Sometimes that day it was probably a good solid 18 to 24 inches of snow. It was cool, but I got up on this buck and I had him 55 yards just waiting for him to clear. It was about a 160 buck, and I'm 37 degrees slope. I'm up to my waist in the snow, and I'm just waiting for him to clear. And all of a sudden, below him, this buck comes out. And I'm like, "Oh crap, that thing's huge!" And I just stopped him, and I just clicked him with the rangefinder. Rangefinder said 82, and I'm like, I have this cut chart on my arm, and I just went with it. I says, and I hit. I shot. I was shooting white arrows, and I heard it hit. And I run around the point and just saw blood everywhere in the snow. And I'm like, sweet. And I looked over to my right and I saw a deer buck go up under a tree. So I was focused 100% there because I thought that was him. Well, in retrospect, following him, he was standing under a tree down there. I could have got a second shot on. What had happened is because I tracked him all over the place. I never did see him again. And my buddies went in there the next day and they saw him, and he had a slice right through the top of his withers. And that's just another lesson in rangefinders: don't cut that kind of slope correctly. And that's another challenge on your, like, say, an ibex hunt. People need to be very, very aware that rangefinders do not cut slope that precisely. Now, there's a new program out that I've been working with, and I really think there's a lot of potential with it. But cut charts are tricky because they're not that fast. But this guy's charts talked him into, extrapolating it out even by the yard. So if you build like a little flip cheat, you could actually make a little cut chart that's pretty fast. But it's precisioncutarchery.com.
Okay.
And I think the guy really gets it. And I've looked at some of the cuts. I've shot a bunch of them in, and they seem to be pretty spot on. I mean, that's a very intense, highly precision undertaking because if you're going to go into a terrain like sheep hunting, goat hunting, ibex hunting, you really need to get out and shoot your bow in some extreme slopes. You need to absolutely
100%.
100% take a target with you and sight tapes and make sure you re-sight in when you get where you're going. I was up elk hunting this year and I live at 4,500 feet and I've probably mentioned this on half a dozen of these podcasts, but at 4,500 feet, when I went to 9,500 feet, I believe I was 10 inches high at 100 yards.
That big of a difference from only 5,000 feet? That's
Yeah.
crazy.
Now, part of the reason is I'm shooting a gold tip force arrow with 4 foot 2.1. So the larger it's ballistic coefficient, right? Just like a gun or anything else. The bigger you shoot an arrow, the bigger the fletchings, the faster that arrow slows down, the more it's going to be affected by air density. So if you take a pierce arrow in that same scenario, and there, I was going to shoot actually Black Label Quantums, but I just struggle at my draw length, it's just so hard to keep them stiff enough. And unless I shoot that glue in thorn broadhead and keep the weight down in the front of them. So, but in a pierce in that situation, you might be looking at 6 inches higher instead of,
Yeah, I don't know. So like when I live here in Arizona, I'm at 1500.
okay.
Actually about 1200. So but let's say 1500, and for instance in Utah, where I would mule deer hunt, I'm at 10,000 feet. So
Okay.
that's pretty big difference.
Yeah.
I was about 3 inches high
At 100.
at at 80.
80. So I would guess you'd be 4 or 5 inches high, maybe even 6 at 100, because it really that's where it really starts to fall off. And I mean that was 2 foot a second difference on a sight tape. So if you take a 2 foot a second different sight tape and you lay it up against it, the other one, you will see that at 50, there's basically no difference. At 80, you got a tiny bit. At 100, you got more. At 130, 140, you're going to have incrementally more. And the faster that arrow is slowing down, the more variation you're going to see. So, who knows? Maybe some of that 10, 12 inches was just margin of error. I don't know. I shot three arrows and they all went all in the top of my that brown block target. And I was like, holy
This is
crap.
flat. You're set shooting on flat, not
Yeah,
knowing.
very flat. Yeah, I shoot right on a road. I'm about as anal as they get. So but I have actually have tried that before, and I believe I was using pierce arrows when I tried it, or chaoses, and I actually didn't feel like I noticed as much difference. But there's you gotta shoot a lot of arrows. That's the problem with this cut data is how much of it is the angle affecting the way you're making the shot, putting your hand in the grip, so on and so forth, and how much of it is actual the math, right? And you have to, even in target archery, I kind of tend to play to my weaknesses. So uphill, you tend to have a tendency to drop your bow arm because gravity's not helping you. Downhill, the bow's kind of just pulling away from you in a parallel plane. And you can actually get in around behind your shot. When you get real steep uphill, one of the big problems is to see right here where I stretched out. When we're here,
Yeah,
you
you're
can't
not.
get around here. You just can't.
Right.
And so I remember one time I was in a tournament in Wales, and it was these European Pro Series, and these guys love to just put a vicious course on. And it was so much fun. And we were standing in this old World War II fort, and I was in a bunker. And then they had a target elevated on a stand. So we're shooting like, I don't even remember what it was. It was like 55-degree slope, and it was about 14 or 15 yards. That's it. And I thought I knew everything about sight leveling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my bow was perfectly level. And I get up there and I shoot and I hit to the left and I'm like, what the freak? I mean, we're talking 14 yards. I mean, I hit this far left and I'm like, I did it again. I'm like, finally ran into Dave Cousins because he was tearing it up. And I'm like, Dave, what's going on here? Do you know? He said, hell, I don't know. I just aimed to the right. He said, and so I get to the last target of the day and it's the same thing. It's 20 yards, 40 plus degree uphill. And I just aimed the right side of the dot and smoked him. But the whole way home, this thing's like, it's in my craw. It's like, I was like, what happened? And I was having a conversation with a guy and I can't even remember. And he's like, well, yeah, I just gauged the cables in against the side of the scope to know kind of where my torque's at. I'm like, oh crap, that's exactly what it is. And I don't even know where I got this idea from. But I was shooting a PSC Dominator at the time, and the Dominator is a shoot-through riser, right? So you had it's an ambidextrous riser. So you had mounts for a sight on this side and mounts for a sight on this side. So I took a second sight and I come around behind.
Uh-huh.
And I put it in my sight window there. And I don't even know where I seen this thing. I don't even know where it came from, but I don't even know what it's used for. But it's a bow fishing sight that has two wires like this.
Yep.
You have any idea what they use it for bow fishing? I don't understand the premise.
Well, it's because you're always shooting like this down into the water. Oh. So it's very easy for you to, you know.
Okay. Torque the, is that what it's for? Torque too, huh?
Yep. It's exactly what
basically what I did is I got the idea that I would put my pin between these two lines. And so I modified the side a little bit so I could get the lines far enough apart where they weren't really distracting me. Mm-hmm. And dude, I went to the next tournament in Wales and I beat the dog snot out of those guys. Cause as soon as I got to the position where I was shooting a steep shot and that pin wasn't between those wires, all I did is make myself pull a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. That pin goes over between the two wires, and I mean, I'm right down the pipe. So there is a little bit of logic for a rear sight style apparatus, you know. But again, it needs to run something like this that runs parallel so that when you track your sight up and down, it's going right between it. So
I got two. Well, for me, that's why I still shoot the stupid retina lock sight. I know it's not a great sight, like people.
Oh, okay. That's that one that's got the.
Yeah, do I have one on my desk here? No.
That little.
Yeah, it's got a little
four-way level
torque indicator on it, right?
Right.
And I don't have that problem shooting angles anymore.
I remember my
bubble's right, and my, you know, obviously I got to have the it's set up right, but if I have it set up right, I don't have issues shooting up or down because of that, because I just manipulate it to get it. And before that, what I would do is if I was shooting on an angle, and even flat, this works too, I would just glance up and look at my string that and see if it was tracking in the cam grooves. And if it wasn't perfectly straight, then I knew I was torquing the bow.
Right. Yeah. I still try to run 18 to 20 pounds of hold weight on my hunting bows because when you're, like you said, you're all bundled up and you're clothed up and you're out of position and your foot's 2 foot above the next one, that's when you're going to torque the bow. And people, you know, I get in conversations. I've been working for Gold Tip for here almost 22 years. And I remember a guy calling up one time and he wanted a heavier arrow for penetration. And I don't know, we got off on a diatribe about sight leveling. And he's like, I don't need to worry about third axis. I only shoot 30 yards. I said, dude, you just told me you shot a deer in the shoulder and you're worried about it. Maybe your bow was off far enough to make you hit the 3 inches to the right that you smoked him in the shoulder. I mean, do you ever think about that? And he's like, yeah, not really. But it's true. In fact, when I was, you know, working with Hamsky and the Hamsky level was kind of my idea. I had the guy at Specialty make me one without the pin in it. And I thought, because I knew it had to be done at full draw to get the torque load. And I was just wasn't thinking it through. And I had sold 30 of them things and I brought one into the guys at work and gave one to each one of them. And I was all like excited about this, you know, thing, and it was going to just solve all these problems that I'd had. And Preston Edwards, who worked for us at the time, he's like, that ain't going to work. And I got all buttered. I'm like, what do you mean it ain't going to work? Works perfect. And he's like, no, the bubble in that level is going to torque the same as the one in your sight. And I thought about it for a second and I thought, shit, he's right. And so it took me about 3 days to come up with the pin feature. But I remember that moment looking back once I discovered the pin, you know, the pin running parallel to the first axis. And that kind of, I don't know if I got that off of a spot hog sight because they have a wire they line the pins up with. So the wire becomes the first axis. So that's what you level off of. So it makes leveling really simple. Although I hate the wire in my sight picture.
Just
I don't like it.
distracting.
Yeah, it is. I don't like it a lot. Some guys like it. I didn't like it. So, I had a Matthews switchback that year. We went to Bowcast at the Bird, which is now Total Archery Challenge. And they had this stall sheep shot that was like 109 yards off this cliff. And I kept hitting it clear up in the front neck shoulder area. And I was just like, there's not enough wind here to do that. And sure enough, I go back and I check that bow, and it's a half a bubble out from static to full draw. So what that means to you guys watching is if I take a bow and I level it in a vise, third axis, do you see a lot of guys do this? And then I draw the bow back, it puts a different torque load on it. And depending on how you grip the bow, whether you're pushing inward or outward, you're going to change that bubble's relationship to the plane of motion. So that bubble's got to run perfectly perpendicular to plane of motion or it runs out. And the reason you get a left or a right is you're canting the bubble. So long story short, the way I now analyze this is I wasn't seeing near as big a shift in my target bows. Okay. I was seeing that was a Matthews Apex days. So you had a really stiff limb. The older guys like Frank Pearson, they probably never experienced this that much because we were shooting 48-inch axle-to-axle bows with 8-inch brace heights. I mean, the cable side might have moved that much, right? So they were getting no shift from static to full draw. So a static third axis measurement was not really showing up downrange, so they never really caught on to the fact. But once you get high let-off hunting bows, where you've got ability to torque it, and people that are inexperienced, especially, this is another advocate for a square grip. Okay, a flat back square grip, rounded grips, thin rounded grips rotate faster. And I'll give you another test. We ran a video one time where we were just showing the difference in carbon arrows and basically showing the memory and how they affected accuracy downrange. And so I took a shooting machine and I shot one arrow three times before I start any tests. So I picked this Matthews LX up. It had that old Matthews rounded grip on it.
That was my favorite bow.
The grip sucked.
You know what? It's all about what you got used to. You know,
Well,
I
sure,
shot that bow for a
but hear
very
me
long
out.
time.
So we put this bow in the shooting machine and I shoot the same arrow three times. That arrow strung horizontally that far, 10 inches. I took the grip off. I put I believe, a Shrewd flat
True.
grip on it, retuned it in the shooting machine, and that thing went inside out in a dime. If that's not the proof that the load transfer in the bow is controlled by the grip, I don't know what is.
Oh, 100%. That's,
So,
matter of fact, that was the bow that I learned that trick. I learned that trick for
Cam.
the cam. Yeah. Matter
Yeah.
of fact, I don't know if you know him or not, but Randy, who owns Archery Headquarters in Chandler, but he also is the inventor of the Easy Fletch.
Okay.
And a number of different things. I think he's got some programs out there and stuff that he invented. But he's the one that told me about that because he's like, you see this little wear on your wood grip right here? That means that you're consistently throwing this torque into it. And he's like, you know, so
Yeah.
I started looking up. I started looking up, and eventually I trained my body not to do what I was doing. And then, you know, I don't remember when it was, but then, you know, that retinal oxide came out. The first one was horrendous, but I was actually tree stand hunting, which I find that you tend to torque the bow way more when you're in a tree stand, than, when you're on ground, just because of the situation and the angles and whatever. I had this buck come running underneath me chasing this doe, and I'm waiting for him to stop, and I was at full draw, and I wasn't quite used to that whole looking at the retina lock thing yet in a hunting situation. Yeah, practice, you can slow down. When you're in a hunting situation, everything's sped up. So I just happened to look up at it, and I'm like, I am torquing the shit out of this bow right now. I am torquing so much that I'm gonna miss my mark. And he's only 19 yards. I'm gonna miss by, a large margin. And I just eased up my grip, and I brought the retina lock back in sight, and I anchored, I shot, and he went 20 yards and died. And I was like, there we go, perfect. But had I not had that, I probably would have took that shot, because I was thinking to myself, oh, 19 yards, he's done, right? But I was really torquing the heck out of that bow.
Well, that just goes to the importance of really practicing and hunting like conditions with your hunting bow. And that's kind of tied
100%.
into the kind of the second question I was going to ask you is how you prepare, how do you prepare for the hunting season? I mean, how do you prepare for it physically? How do you prepare for it mentally?
Yeah.
Everybody's a little different. I think you're kind of diehard at this by
I am.
not
Well,
some.
my background in college, my first degree, was exercise physiology and corporal fitness and wellness. So, I used to be the strength and conditioning coach, and I used to do like sports specific training with the soccer players and the tennis players at Grand Canyon University. So when I In since 1998, when I graduated, I changed my mentality. I always had the mentality of being physically fit and hunting, and that it helped, and so on and so forth. But I never looked at it through, this is a sport that needs sport-specific training. If I was training for the Olympics, and I view every hunt as a, as I'm going to the Olympics, if I was training for that, what would I be doing? So I started putting myself into what we said a couple times already on this podcast, lifelike scenarios, basically. You're not, when you go hunting, you're not going to be standing in front of a block target at 40 yards with a dot in the center on flat ground and a perfect archer's tee,
With
be
a
able to
single pin
count through all
movable
these
sight.
stats. Yeah, you're not. Everything, like I said earlier, it's everything's sped up. And the terrain is different. The angles are different. You're dealing with so many. You might be on your knees, you might be on your butt, and you might be sliding around a bush. You might have to come a full draw and then step up. So I literally started incorporating every one of these things that I think that I would be faced with. And that's how my practice is. Now, am I going to be like, even when I go archery, or excuse me, 3D archery hunting, or excuse me, 3D archery practice, I go shoot a range or whatever. I don't shoot those animals. I shoot them like I'm trying to kill them. I don't shoot them for, I'm trying to shoot a 12 ring, because those targets aren't where they're supposed to be. And more so that, so my brain doesn't go, hey, I want to shoot it here. Oh no, wait, no, I really want to shoot it here when I'm faced with the situation. I even so that's how I started bow hunting coyotes. I was like, what's a perfect way for me to get constant year-round, and it was fast. It's like a drive-by shooting, coyotes come flying in, and they only give you, a second or two to
Get a shot off,
you had a shot off.
I think you guys have plenty. I thought I was going to die by coyote over in 4A one year. I was like, good Lord,
There
they're everywhere.
is. Yeah, I've spoken to a couple of people over here, and they've done flyovers and killed like 20,000. It doesn't even like make a dent. So, but yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, so my philosophy is always be putting yourself in lifelike scenarios and positions that you're going to be faced with in the field, and try to think about everything, you know, shooting from around the rock, over the top of things, angles, and so on and so forth. So we were talking about the Ibex hunt, that 2015 hunt. I was so determined that I was going to get one. This is my first, I had gone 9 years of applying and I hadn't, and I drew it on the 10th year. I was like, nobody's ever done this with a bow on film. I'm going to do it. Okay. So I was the first guy to do it on film with a bow. And I wanted to get a nice representation of it. And I was just hell bent. I'm like, so I'm going to do everything possible. I was shooting, because everybody I talked to was like, oh man, the wind is crazy, the angles. I was going up six floors in parking complexes and putting targets down and shooting like that far down.
Oh yeah.
Like those are the things that I was doing. And you could see a couple of those pictures in my, or clips in my video.
I got a lot of arrows laying around West Mountain down here.
Yeah. And that's what it takes. Like I was taking... I was taking like one of those round Reinhardt targets. I would go to a cliff and I would chuck it, and wherever it landed, that's where I was shooting it. Like, and usually after I sight in, I should point this out. After I sight in, I don't shoot at anything that has dots on it. I try to shoot at only 3D when I'm preparing myself for hunts. So anyway, I was totally dialed in for that 2015 hunt. 2016, I drew the tag again. And I actually had more opportunities because I knew how to hunt them better. The first time my buddy was there, and I had buddies there, and he was a guide for them. So like I had help.
Right.
Second time I took one of the kids that works for me, actually two of the kids that work for me, in my guide service here to be spotters. And we went, I had more opportunities in 2016 than I had in 2015, but I didn't get one. And part of the problem is leading up to the hunt, I was maybe 50% of the effort that I put into the first hunt in my practice, I put into the second hunt, maybe not even 50%.
Right.
I was like, I put it a lot into my physicality. Like I was still, you know, hiking and I was in good shape, but I wasn't as well practiced. And
there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, even in,
I shot four times.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the two that I just told a story about earlier, you know, that was a wind thing. Another one where I was trying to shoot through this like window of cedars that I was like, oh, I was convinced that I was going to make it through this hole. No, and I smacked the limb and the freaking arrow went flipping off into God knows where. And the other one, the last one, I just flat out missed. I don't know what I did wrong, but I just flat out missed. Like, I don't even know where the arrow hit, to be honest with you. Just, I don't know if I picked the wrong pin, if I had the wrong, you know, angle. I don't know what happened, but I missed.
No, you could have just like did what I did. I told Alan Bowling yesterday, I got on an elk this year down the Vermont, and I got this elk at 20 yards, just facing horns. And I'm like, it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I got a 40. I start with a 40. So I'm thinking 20 yards, I'm just going to put 40, 10 inches low and kill it. And finally he moved off and I get to the top of the ridge and I seen his cows on the other side of the clearing. I ranged him at 85 and I looked down to my sight and it was set on 140.
Mm.
So normally it's set on 100, but I was the last time I'd shot it was at camp at 140, and that would not have ended well. And we were in Alaska last year hunting caribou, and they were talking about a guy they had up there sheep hunting. So this talking a dull sheep hunt, you know, with a bow, and they get this guy on a sheep and he 50 yards and he shoots five freaking times, shoots a group like that over the top of the sheep before he figures out he didn't have his sight set on the right.
Really?
You know, five or six pin movable, you have to have.
I know you're a movable guy, man, but Jesus, that's why I'm so anti.
No, I shoot seven pins on a mover. So I run 40 to 100. Yeah, 40 to 100. And it gives me the option. I shot both my Caribou at 66 last year, and absolute both of them, I dialed the sight. Mm-hmm. I had time, but I want options. You know, a lot of people are, there's kind of a trend around for single pin movables, and, yeah, and I will give you concessions that it's more accurate standing in your backyard blinking.
100%.
But it's not practical.
It's not. I shoot a 7-pin fixed. That's it. I got, if I can't get within 80 yards of a freaking animal, then I used to. I mean, there's a video out there of me shooting an antelope at 97, and I've killed my fair share over 80, but I just started thinking to myself, I'm like, I need to start just, this is my window, right? I'm going to give myself this structure. Even though I'm physically capable of it, I know the bow's capable of it, I know the equipment's going to do it, this is my limitations. You know, I got 20, my top pin, 80, my last pin. Yeah, okay, 85, I might, you know, cheat. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I can't do that.
But
I watch a buck come up out of a coulee on my buddy. It stops at 92, and he's up there fumbling at his sight, and I'm thinking, I got an 80-yard pin. What would I be doing?
Yeah.
And I'd be doing the same thing he was doing. So the next year I put a 90 in, mm-hmm. and I'll be danged if I didn't have to use it. But it was on a second shot.
Yeah.
I put one in the shoulder because I was rushing, and I had an opportunity at just almost at 92, and then I had an opportunity at 96 and drained him, you know, and I thought the reason I killed that thing was because I put that 90 yard pin in there.
Yeah. You
know? Well, not that I wouldn't have killed him anyway, but.
But still, I know what you're saying, man. I get it. And I'm not against it. I'm not one of those guys that say, hey, that's unethical or whatever. Cause mm-hmm. I don't believe that. I believe it's unethical if you weren't Tim Gillingham and you didn't practice that shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you didn't take the time, and even, I know what you put into what you do. So
it's like tournaments. Even if I go out here and I'm shooting unmarked 3D, for example, and I have spent 2 rounds per day for 2 straight weeks before I go to a tournament, mm-hmm. and I'm just killing it, and I know it, I go to that tournament expecting to win.
Right.
If I go out there and I haven't shot a round in 1 round in 2 weeks, I go to that tournament with a lot of trepidation.
Yeah, you're going there hoping to win.
And I'm stressing out, and I'm, yeah, and you're going there, like, exactly, you're going hoping to win. So, and it from a mental psyche, it's massive. You know, I remember one year hunting mule deer up here on the front, and I was chasing this big buck all freaking day. I mean, he was a stud, 200-inch deer, 195, 200-inch deer. And finally, I pop over this little, and it's just oak brush infested, super hard to get a shot. And I pop over this little ridge, and boom, there's this buck following a doe. And in my mind, it was him. I clicked him with a rangefinder, said 82. And I just remember the thought process in my mind. It was like, that thing might as well have been 20.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was so dead, and I just center punched him, and I get up to him, and I'm like, what freaking deer is this?
Yep.
It was a different deer. It was a big frame deer. It was a nice deer. I would have still shot him, but it was not. I just thought I'd killed that stomper, and he'd given me the slip somewhere.
Yeah. I've done that more than a few times.
I talked to a guy this year that shot a mountain goat in BC like that. And he said the guide told him there was two goats, and one was just a slob, like 54 mm-hmm. inches. I mean, just a wow. monster, yeah. maybe world record. And they just, the wrong one stood up at the wrong time. And yeah, they were pretty sick about it, but they still killed a nice goat. It was still a 47, 48 inch goat, but
yeah,
compared to a 54, whew.
No, I've done that, unfortunately, so many times. That, because, and I think a lot of guys that have consistent success will do that, because if, at least for me, this is what I know the mechanism that causes that, is that as soon as I go into kill mode, everything else disappears. All yeah. I see is where I need to shoot. And I mean, the two times that stick out to me the most, matter of fact, it was also Utah. I have this on film. It's on my YouTube if you guys want to see it. But I was sitting on this buck from like noon And I think it might have been like 7 p.m. by the time they finally got up. And they got out, and there was 3 bucks together. There was a really big one, a medium-sized one, and a small one. And, you know, the big buck was in the lead the whole time. And then I couldn't see him. They came around this, like, the roll of the mountain was so steep that I was only going to be able to see him when they popped out right in front of me at like 40, 50 yards. And I could see tips of antlers coming, so I drew back. I didn't want to get busted drawing back, so I drew back, and it stepped out. And when it stepped out, it was a medium-sized buck. And I shot him. I drilled him. He ran like 20 yards and then tumbled down the mountain for like 200 yards. It was terrible pack out. But when I got up to him, like, this is not the buck that I was trying to kill, you know? And then the other time that sticks out with me most was I was hunting, I was in Illinois. I was tree stand hunting, and this doe's coming down this trail, and she's got this freaking giant buck, probably like 170, beautiful 10 point, following her. And behind him was like a 130 something, you know, buck, decent buck, nice buck. And he actually had some cool character and stuff. It was a cool buck, but they were running. And they were chasing around, and they ran up to my right where I couldn't shoot because there was a bunch of brush, and they ran behind my stand, and they were running behind me. I hit my can call a couple times, and the doe comes flying around the trail that comes down my left, and she runs and she stops. So where she stops, I drew back because I knew, you know, in the rut, that's exactly what happens. They stop in a spot, and the buck goes there, smells that spot, and then, you know. So she t starts taking off again. Here comes the buck. He stops in the same spot. Boom, drilled him. Literally drops like right there. I hit him so good. And I'm like, that's not the right buck. And I look over, and the other buck's looking up at me in the tree stand, going like, got you. You know? And I'm
Oh,
like, I can't believe it. I mean,
it's funny. You're right.
I
You
was
do. You just
heartbroken.
once I get the same way. Is just once you decide to make that shot. I shot in 2009. I had drew the expo tag, and I had an elk tag down on the boulder, and I'd got on these elk, and I got in pretty close, and it was the second day, and I had a cow at like 22 yards. And I could hear the bull. I could kind of see him a frame through the trees, but I couldn't tell you if he was 330, 360, 3 what, you know, broken off on six tines. I remember he turned around and he was coming, and my mind's just scoping, where am I going to get a shot? And I saw just a royal that was pretty good with some knobbiness to it. And I just went to this opening. As soon as his leg went forward in the opening, I hammered a trigger. And my first thought was like, oh shit, I have no idea what I just shot. But that was one of them bulls that, you know, when I got closer and closer and closer, I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. You know, he was 60-inch main beams, 360 bull, just a beautiful bull. I just everything I could have wanted, you know. I mean, but
That buck right there, matter of fact, that one that's up there, that's a wrong buck.
yeah.
There was a buck bedded, and I stalked all the way over to it, and I came over the top, and I made a shot 55 yards, killed him, dropped him in his tracks. And I get over to it. I'm like, this is not the buck that I was going after. I mean, he's a good buck, and it was pretty close, but the one that I went after was definitively a 4x4. And probably about 3 inches wider. This is a 3x4.
Yeah. Oh well. You know, it's still you know, I was talking to Alan yesterday, and he's just obsessed with killing Boone and Crockett, and he's willing to pass them up, but he's a good hunter, man. He's just one of them obsessed guys. He's really like into the equipment, into the shooting, into learning, you know, but you know, willing to go home with nothing in order to kill big animals. And you know, that to each his own, you know. It's like that's the challenge, you know. Some people want that extra challenge. I mean, when we grew up, it was about meat, right? You know, we that's all we ate as kids, you know. And you know, but it grows with you. You know, you want the challenge. I'm a competitive person. I mean, I want the challenge, but I also want the experience, you know. But I also want the experience for like my nephews. And one of the, you know, the next thing we want to talk about a little bit is how do we bring this to the next generation? It becomes increasingly more challenging to get young people and new people into bow hunting. It seems like the resources are less and less, and everybody's so busy, and it's just so hard to get families to hunt together with the limited amount of tags and things that are available. And you know, give us a little your thoughts on that. I know you've been involved a little bit on some education in this regard, so.
So, you know, I think, well, let me preface this with a story. So, a few years ago, it was 2016, I was really advocating for R3, and I started an initiative called Hunter Up. And, you know, it was about getting hunters to be better to each other, you know, to start realizing that we're all on the same team, that we're all, you know, we're all working towards the same thing. We may not hunt the same, you know. You might be a rifle hunter, might be a bow hunter, you might be an elk hunter, might be a deer hunter, whatever the case may be, but we're all in the same team. And so I was pushing the, you know, I was advocating for the R3, not necessarily pushing it. And that R3, if people don't know what that is, it's a program, nationwide program, that gets hunters reactivated, recruits new hunters. So that's part of it. And that was the big part that I was really pushing, was the recruiting the new hunters. And I was met with a bunch of opposition. And hunters were just like, why do I want to bring in somebody else? I already got no, you know, I got too much competition as it is, da 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 da. You know, there's no places to hunt. Why would I want to bring somebody else into this? And, you know, and I'd have to explain to them, like, well, you know, the hunter's voice is getting smaller and smaller. And even if the numbers stay the same, because we're not that far off in how many people hunt today as they did in 1980, you know, within a million or so. But we occupy less of the population. Back in 1980, we were 10%, and now we're 5%. You know, so that's the big difference there. And, you know, in 1980, I think there was less than 4 billion people in the world, and now there's close to 8 billion people in the world. So we've doubled, you know, as a population. And so I'm like, you don't need to. One, if you bring on somebody new, like, you know, you're talking to a guy at work, whatever, and you take him out hunting, chances are that person is not going to be as sick with it as you are. They didn't grow up with it. They're not going to, you know, to be doing, I don't know how many trips a year you do, but, you know, for a long time I was spending 90 days afield. You're not going to get that. You're not going to get that out of, you
The
know,
average person.
your buddy at work. So you're not really creating that much competition. And chances are he might be that person that, you know, does it for 1 weekend a year, 5 days a year, whatever the case may be, you know, takes one tag, but you just created an ally. You just created another voice, another person to advocate for hunting. So
Yeah, I think I was talking about this with Ted Nugent a little bit because I always had the idea that, you know, I run into a lot of people on airplanes, and a lot of people, I mean a large percentage of people, when they find out I shoot archery professionally, just think it's cool, right? It's a cool endeavor. And I think we could get a lot of support for the hunting community simply by breaking down the stereotype of what people believe a hunter is. You know, people that aren't familiar, they don't know people that are hunters, but if they know somebody that shoots competitively, I think the competitive shooting sports is a good way to develop allies. They may not necessarily hunt. They like the competition aspect of it, whether it be shotgun, rifle, air rifle,
sure,
archery. You know, we're running.
Those are great ways to get people. Yeah.
So it's kind of the same thing. You know, some people think you're crazy for the amount of hunting you do, but you're always going to have, in any endeavor, you're going to have those people that just take it to the 10th level, you know?
Oh yeah. 100%.
But you also want, you know, I also want my nephews to be able to experience what I've experienced, you know, what it's like to be on the top of a mountain at daylight, the smells, you know, the glassing up of a velvet mule deer, you know, and the excitement that that brings, or, you know, hearing an elk bugle laying in bed and just seeing just, you know, all the things that we've seen, you know, it's just hard to impart that to other people, you know, that are completely ignorant of it.
Yeah. We're actually trying to do that. So I don't know, Tim, if I ever talked to you about this or not, but I'm the vice president of Howlful Wildlife. So we are working primarily on hunting advocacy. We're basically we're educating the hunters on issues, and we are giving them the tools to connect with decision makers to voice their opinion in a very easy way. And we're working on this project right now that hunting is human. And one of the big things, we didn't say it yet, but you alluded to it, is there's this perception, there's this idea of what the hunter is, you know, toothless hillbilly, willy-nilly, running around in back of pickup trucks, drinking beer and shooting at everything, right? Like that's what is painted of the hunter. Or that, or we're just this like bloodthirsty, we're shooting things, lopping off their head, leaving bodies out there.
Right.
You know, that's the trophy hunter. You know, I'm just want to stand with my trophy. And that has all came about from the anti-hunting. They've been systematically before you and I were babies or born, they've been painting this picture of what the hunter is.
Right.
And you hit the nail on the head when you started saying we need to start talking to people and start changing that perception of what it is that we are, giving them the truths, letting them know that, hey, wild things and wild places exist primarily because of hunting and what we've done, not just from a financial standpoint, but from all the effort and stuff that we've put into growing those habitats and growing those animals. And it's really on us, archers, hunters, to portray to the non-hunting people that don't know what we are for real. And that idea doesn't take much, you know, having conversations with people at work. You know, you want to educate yourself first before you start, you know, talking about things that you don't know about 100%, because you don't want to say the wrong thing. But educate yourself and share your human experiences. You know, I bring the meat home, my family, you should come over. Let's have a barbecue. You can have some milk. And, you know,
it's funny. I was doing financial planning one year, and one of the clients was, you know, he was just entertaining me. I was young, you know, but he found out as a hunter, and he wanted me to bring some elk meat because he'd had a friend that was a hunter. And so he cooked us up elk steaks and stuff. And it was a good interaction, you know?
Yeah. But it's all about that. So again, you don't necessarily have to make them hunters, but if your neighbor who never hunts comes over to your house and has, you know, two barbecues a year with you, and you're eating elk and you're eating deer or whatever, when the ballot comes up or when something comes in front of them, now you created an ally.
Exactly. So instead of there being 5% of us, now there's 10 or 15, you know?
Well, yeah, there's 80% in the middle, right?
Right.
Or, excuse me, 90% in the middle now. is five anti-hunting, 5% is hunting. You know, it's reaching that 90% in the middle, that middle ground, and having them understand what we are and not to accept the narrative that is being fed to them by the other side.
Right, exactly. So, before we, get this video posted, I want to, give people some links to where they can find some of these organizations that you're talking about, some of the
Sure.
links. I mean, you talked about providing links to their, I believe their congressmen and decision makers as to, I think that's what people need, honestly. They need to know who to call, so, or who to email
Right.
to get their voice out, because that's, people like, well, contact your congressman. Well, most people don't even know who their congressmen are. Most
Well,
people don't.
that's that it. You know what it is? That they don't even know who their congressman is, and that congressman may not have anything to do with the situation that you're talking about. You know, hey, contact your congressman about this, but it's in the commission level. It has nothing to do with the congressman, or it's in this committee. So what we've done at Howl for Wildlife is actually make it, we created the easy button. There were so many obstacles in the way for people to get involved. We try to take all that out of the way. So if you come to the website and you go to our action center and you click on any action, it's going to give you all the information about what's going on so you can educate yourself if you want to.
You say it's howl or howa?
Howl, HOWL.
Like your hat. Okay.
Yep, like my hat.
Okay.
Howl for Wildlife. Anyway, so the and it's howlforwildlife.org is the website. If you go to the action center and you click on one of the actions, you can read about it, you can educate yourself. On the bottom of it, at the end of it, it will ask you for your name. Sometimes it might ask you for your phone number, but it's your name and your email address most of the time. And you click send, and it sends a email, and it's not a canned email. We upload anywhere from like 100 to 2,000 different variations of an email, anywhere from 100 to 2,000 variations of a subject line, and that email randomly goes out to every decision maker on that piece of policy or that piece of legislation that is that we're trying to deal with.
Well, that's good, because
They
it needs
get
to
it
be
and they read it.
organized and shareable like that. So we can go in and share it to our friends and our contacts. And, I have 15, 20, 30,000, whatever, or Levi Morgan's got 150,000 people that he can access to. If they make it easy for them and really give them the steps to do so, I think you're going to have a lot more effect on it. Yeah.
Well, let me tell you this. So we have we're the only organization that has a free membership option, okay? Because when we started this, we didn't want to say, no, you can't get involved in saving hunting because you don't want to give the organization $30 and become a member.
Right.
Okay, that's number one. Number two, in I think we've had, I'd have to go back and double check, but I believe that 89% of the legislation and actions that we've gotten involved in, we've either won or progressed.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And we've done that. We have about 45,000 members right now, I think, 46,000 members. We've done that with 46,000 people. And we've done that with only approximately 8% of the 46,000 being involved in each
Well, yeah, and I
at
think,
any perfect at any given time, right?
yeah.
Okay, let me give you some other numbers real quick. There's 16 million hunters in the United States alone. Okay. If we had 10% of that 16 million, that's 1.6 million, that got involved in every single action, we would never lose another hunting thing ever again.
Yep. I agree. I think that same thing happens with progressive politics. It's all being run by the person with the loudest mouth. And that's the crazy leftist,
Well, that's honestly, it's that's politics. on both sides of the fence that have been that way forever, a
Right.
politician is going to do what's going to make him look the him or her look the best
To his
to
constituents.
his constituents. So if he or she believes that his constituents want A, he's going to do A. If he believes that they want B, then she's going to do B. And that is why it's important that, hunters get involved. Because I mean, I can't tell you how many times already now I've heard, oh, you want us to be activists? That's for libtards. Okay. So you let the quote unquote libtards be active, let them be the squeaky wheel. And guess what?
Sooner or later, you have
Right.
nothing. Yeah,
Yeah, exactly.
I've had people tell me that about, well, I don't get into politics. Well, if you don't get into politics, politics is going to get into you.
Yeah,
They're
100%.
going to own you.
You need to
So,
be active. You need to be involved, because if you're
well,
not
the whole
involved,
people
it's
just
going to
feel
go
like,
away.
yeah, people felt like they've lost their voice, and I think this is good to hear that you've put something together that people start to feel like maybe they can make a difference, because I do believe that's the big kicker there. They got to feel like they're actually making a difference. So,
And we are, and they
yeah.
could see it. And that's one of the
So it's
beauties about our system.
yeah. So Howl for Wildlife is your organization. I encourage you guys to go over and look at this. We're going to wrap up here. We've hit about an hour time frame. What's your channel? Do you have a YouTube channel
Yeah,
or
just I for my personal stuff, just look up John Stallone. I mean, YouTube.
Yeah, if you want to watch some of John's videos, he's got a really good video on this ibex hunt we were talking about. John Stallone, you can pick him up on Instagram. He's got a podcast, that's pretty regular. So, if you want any technical information we talked about, look at Gold Tip's YouTube channel. We've got a lot of stuff up on our YouTube channel. All these Archery Ops podcasts are on our YouTube channel. There's hammers hacks that go along with that. Some of those hammers hacks I was gonna kind of mention, one of the things that I do to set my grip on my bow when we talked about shooting slopes and stuff is a little O-ring under a piece of duct tape. One of those hammers hacks is about that subject. So if you want to, look at what we're talking about, feel free to go over to Gold Tip's YouTube channel and check that out. So we hope you like the podcast. We're going to continue to bring it to you. This is episode number 10. And we hope to bring a lot of exciting and new guests to you, and hopefully we can all learn together.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, before you go, there's a great way to get even more info and tips. Follow this podcast and check out Gold Tip on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Thanks for listening. And as always, start tough and stay true.